Mexico is making its mark in the tech sector. In the last decade, Mexico's tech industry grew 3 times faster than the global average. Most of that growth is fueled by demand from the United States. To keep the expansion going, experts say it will take financial and education reform in Mexico. Here's Monica Ortiz Uribe from member station KJZZ.
The star of the tech world in Mexico is this woman.
Por supuesto que existe Blanca Treviño. Existe una Blanca Treviño apasionada en todo lo que hace.
Blanca Treviño is the CEO of Softec, Mexico's biggest technology service company. Here she speaks on a video for Mexico's Forbes magazine. Softec spans 4 continents, providing software support to clients that include Fortune 500 companies. It's a business sector that's rapidly growing in Mexico, thanks in large part to its proximity to the United States.
I think it's safe to say that without the U.S., the Mexico market would not be doing very well.
Morgan Yates is an analyst with the IT consulting firm Gartner. He says 3/4 of Mexico's tech services is for the United States. That is, large global companies like Walmart or Coca-Cola that need help managing massive computer databases. For years, India and China have been the main providers, but that's changing.
More and more partnerships are happening between the U.S. and Mexico.
U.S. companies tend to mesh better with Mexican providers. Time zones are more compatible, and Mexico is better able to serve a growing Hispanic market within the U.S. But it's not all about IT support and services. It's also about creating original software. This song was embedded into an app for an alternative newspaper using software developed by a Mexican startup called Publish 88. It's one of many tech startups popping up across Mexico. Enrique Lima is the co-founder.
Our first office, 16 years ago, was a table in an apartment of a friend.
Now, their office is a rented house within a quiet residential neighborhood in Monterrey, Mexico's northern industrial hub. Publish 88 licenses software to print publishers that want a multimedia presence. After only a year, Publish 88 already has clients like the Mexico editions of National Geographic magazine and Cosmopolitan. Emilio Arriaga is the startup's chief financial officer.
Publish 88 is an incredible example of what you can do if you set yourself to your goals and you plan and you work hard.
But while big Mexican companies like Softec are doing business with big corporations worldwide, it's a lot tougher for small startups like Publish 88 to score foreign clients. There's no version of Silicon Valley in Mexico, at least not yet. The country still thirsts for innovation. No one knows that better than Guillermo Zafa, a 40-year veteran of the industry here.
Estamos caminando con el freno de mano puesto.
We are driving with our handbrake on, he says. Zafa directs an IT business alliance in Monterrey. He says Mexico has important challenges to overcome.
Capital humano. No tenemos insuficiencia para la demanda que tenemos.
Human capital is one challenge, Zafa says. Most engineering graduates in Mexico end up in the manufacturing sector. The other challenge, he says, is financing. Mexico's banks are not small business friendly. That said, a bill meant to reform the banking system is currently making its way through the Mexican Congress. Meanwhile, Mexican universities like the Tec de Monterrey are nurturing the country's future entrepreneurs. At this interactive study center, you'll find bright colors, foosball tables, and trampolines, all part of an atmosphere meant to stimulate ideas. It works for freshman Rodrigo Medina.
Well, I'm working on an app that helps you to find objects that you don't remember where you left them.
So. Like your car keys.
Exactly, your car keys, the wallet, the cell phone.
Medina hopes to start his own business when he graduates. His success will be determined in part by how much support he gets from his own country. For NPR News, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
That story from Fronteras, a public radio collaboration in the Southwest that focuses on the border and changing demographics.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Okay, the words of another world leader are captivating huge audiences. Against all Vatican expectations, the Twitter account of Pope Francis, in Latin, has gained more than 100,000 followers. And it's not just Catholics or Latin scholars. The followers come from religions and professions all over the world. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli tells us why the language of the ancient Romans is perfectly suited to 21st century social media.
Pope Benedict launched the first papal Twitter account in December in 8 languages, including Arabic, and soon there were millions of followers. Then letters started pouring in asking why isn't the Pope tweeting in the official language of the Vatican. When the Latin account was launched in January, Vatican officials didn't expect more than 5,000 Latin nerds, that is, followers. But by May, it had surpassed Polish and was in a tie with German at over 100,000.
The surprise has been nerds are in all walks of life. Cab drivers from South Africa, homemakers, for lack of a better term, journalists.
Monsignor Daniel Gallagher is one of the 6 language experts working in the Vatican's Latin office. He says followers are of all ages.
Kids who are 8 years old up to people who are 88 are also following the conversation and participating in the conversation.
Father Gallagher says his office gets letters as well as tweets from all over the world, including from many Muslims and atheists who don't necessarily like the Catholic Church, but are grateful it's keeping the ancient language alive. The Vatican's Latin expert acknowledges that Twitter can encourage shallow thinking and knee-jerk reactions, but he's convinced Latin's flexibility, where one word translated into English or Spanish would require many more, makes it better suited for tweeting than many other languages.
Because it tends to express thoughts as briefly, as concisely, as precisely as possible.
If Twitter had existed during Roman antiquity, the person with the most followers would probably have been the satirist Martial, creator of the epigram. Here's one in 78 characters, including spaces.
Omnia promitis cum tota nocte bibisti. Mane nihil prestas, polio mane bibe.
You were making all kinds of promises when you drink at night. You're just a little tipsy and you say whatever you want. But in the morning, you don't follow through. So, polio, why don't you drink in the morning?
Or this famous poem by Catullus.
Odiet amo quare id faciam fortasse requiris, nescio sed fieri sentio et excrucior.
I hate and I love at the same time. Why do I do this, for perhaps you ask? I have no idea, but I feel it happening and I'm being tortured by it.
In just 2 lines, 82 characters, the meaning of life, a perfect tweet. When the Vatican was preparing to launch the Latin Twitter account, it ruled out the Latin word for the sound of chirping birds, pipilare, saying it didn't sound serious enough for the Pope. So they took a cue from the orator Cicero, who once wrote to a friend while he was in a hurry. Brevi loquentem iam me tempus ipsum facit. Time itself is forcing me to speak briefly. The name of the Twitter account is Summi Pontificis Breviloquentis, the briefly speaking Supreme Pontiff. Silvio Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
As the Romans would say, hic locus est NPR.
Usually when we talk about drones on this program, we are reporting on a strike against terrorist suspects in Yemen or Pakistan. Well, a lot of people and businesses are eager to begin using unmanned aerial vehicles here in the United States. They range from drone manufacturers themselves to police departments, farmers, photographers, and hobbyists. And officials at all levels of government are grappling with what to do about it. Out in Silicon Valley, NPR's tech correspondent Steve Henn stumbled upon a perfect illustration of the current state of the drone industry.
A couple of months ago, on a beautiful spring day in mid-March, I went for a run along a local creek and up toward the foothills of the Santa Cruz Mountains. My goal was Stanford's Dish, a giant radio telescope that's visible for miles. Along the way, I passed 2 separate groups of folks flying drones. So I whipped out my smartphone and started recording.
I walked up to you because you were actually the 2nd drone pilot I've seen on my run today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. You saw a guy with an octocopter, which is Now, those are professional. Those are for carrying red cameras, big SLRs.
But Pablo Lema is just a hobbyist.
So what I have here is called a quadcopter, very well known. I don't like to call it a drone, but it is a remote aerial vehicle that I can control wearing some goggles with a camera that records the flight so I can go beyond line of sight.
It's just a few pounds, and it has a tiny GoPro camera mounted to it.
And I use it just for fun, shooting around the bay, doing some cool videos.
So we're standing on the top of the dish in Stanford right now.
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, a quarter mile from the dish itself.
Yeah.
Describe the flight you just took.
So I flew up first around myself just to check, make sure there was no radio waves around here that would drown me out.
Then Lema flew more than a quarter of a mile up to a multi-million dollar radio telescope over paths and trees and people. And on the way back, he wove through a grove of oaks. You can see a recording of his flight on our website. And because Lema stayed away from airports and below 400 feet, his flight was perfectly legal, kosher in the eyes of the FAA. But the other drone pilot I met that day, named Nick, asked us not to use his last name because when he took flight, he was breaking the law.
Most of what I was shooting is kind of just maybe 10, 15 feet off the creek and just getting these long shots just over the river.
The film was for an environmental group. Nick is a licensed pilot, and he was flying in an area with fewer people. He was closer to the ground, and he never flew the drone past his line of sight. But Nick's flight was illegal because Nick was being paid.
I mean, I'd welcome regulations. I don't like having to feel like I need to be sneaky or, you know, feel like I'm a drug dealer or something. I really love what I do and want it to be a legit business.
Nick began his career as a photojournalist at a newspaper, but his colleagues were losing their jobs, so he decided to rack up debt on his credit card and invest in a couple small 25-pound drones. Now he makes his living taking incredible airborne films. But this means Nick's working in an illegal market.
Today, the FAA really only has one rule, which is no UAVs for commercial applications.
Jonathan Downey is the CEO and founder of Airware. His company makes software that autonomously pilots small UAVs or drones.
One of the applications that we're most excited about was a customer that came to us, a conservancy in Kenya that's going to be using a drone very soon for anti-poaching operations there. They have 4 of the last 7 northern white rhino in the whole world.
The system can pilot the drones for hours independently and alert rangers if there's a problem. In Kenya, these drones will be programmed to read RFID tags on the rhinos. But Airware's system is built so you can plug in almost any kind of sensor to use it to help direct the drone. Drones running the software could sniff the air for chemicals, track heat signatures, or sense motion.
Think of it as like, you know, Microsoft Windows or something. It's an operating system. And like Windows, you can plug different devices, you know, different printers and hard drives or whatever into the hardware.
Chris Dixon is at the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz. His company, along with Google Ventures, just invested more than $10 million in Airware.
Yeah, so the big thing in the market right now is that Congress has mandated the FAA come up with guidelines by 2015. And so 2015, we're expecting some, you know, very specific guidelines that kind of balance, you know, privacy and safety and, you know, commercial interests and a bunch of other things. Until then, I think it's a lot of gray area.
Today, Airware's clients are all abroad, but Nick is here trying to build a business operating in that gray area.
You know, if this venture falls apart or the FAA comes along and tells me I can't be doing this, I have no idea what I'd do. It could turn out very badly.
Integrating full-scale drones into U.S. airspace, drones the size of the Predator, will take at least 2 more years. But the FAA says it expects to issue proposed regulations, opening up the air to small drones like Nick's later this year. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is NPR.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, the British government has recently agreed to pay reparations to more than 5,000 Kenyans who faced torture and other severe abuse during the rebellion against colonial rule in the 1950s. We'll find out what's behind this landmark settlement. But first, we want to follow up on the conversation many Americans have been having about technology and privacy. The fallout continues from the decision by former government contractor Edward Snowden to leak information about a secret government data mining program to the Washington Post and The Guardian. While Snowden's case seems particularly dramatic, he later emerged in a hotel room and has since disappeared. He's only the latest in a series of so-called hacktivists, people who use their technical skills to expose activities of government or corporations with which they disagree. And he, like others, has sparked a wide-ranging and intense debate about whether they are heroes or traitors or something somewhere in between. We wanted to talk more about this with two people who've been thinking about it. Gabriella Coleman is an anthropologist who's immersed herself in the world of hackers and digital activism. She's the author of Coding Freedom, The Aesthetics and the Ethics of Hacking. She's currently working on a new book about the hacker group Anonymous. She's with us from Montreal, Canada. Gabriella, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Also with us, Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen, who recently wrote about this issue as well. Richard Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here.
So, Gabriella, let me start with you. First of all, can I just ask how you got interested in this area of so-called hacktivism?
It was a while ago while I was in graduate school doing a very traditional project, and I had learned about an alternative license, the copyleft, which was invented by free and open source software hackers to free software. And I was just floored by the fact that these technologists were not simply making technology, but reinventing the law.
I think it's fair to say that you're very sympathetic to this particular type of activism. I mean, you've called them the new guardians of our civil liberties. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely the case when you're an anthropologist and you have to spend most of your time with the people you study, you probably shouldn't pick something that you absolutely hate, right? At the same time, you know, you are well positioned to offer some critical insight. And yet I do find it particularly important and interesting that these computer hackers, which are so important for building technology, for the economic sector, are also really making their political voices heard and entering into the political domain in so many diverse ways. I think this is one of the most important stories of our times and will be increasingly important in the future as well.
Okay, but to your own personal view, though, is it fair to say that you think that these activities are positive? I mean, you feel that these activities are in defense of freedom overall, that that is the right thing to do. I mean, other people have called Edward Snowden a hero. Do you think he's a hero?
I think one of the most important elements about these hacker interventions are that they're catalyzing the debate. And I absolutely, absolutely feel that the debate has to happen. That's the most important thing. And I can get 100% behind that. And then both as an anthropologist and maybe as a citizen, I'm more interested in the question, why them? Why are these hackers the ones that are taking a stand as opposed to other groups?
Richard Cohen, you've written about this and you, like a number of other columnists, have taken a very different view. You've said that, for example, just reading from your recent column in the Post, everything about Edward Snowden is ridiculously cinematic. He's not paranoid. He's merely narcissistic. He jettisoned a girlfriend, a career, and undoubtedly his personal freedom to expose programs that were known to our elected officials and could have been deduced by anyone who's ever Googled anything. History will not record him as one of America's most consequential whistleblowers. History is more likely to forget him. Strong words. Tell us more about your point of view here.
That pretty much sums it up. The thing that I find most striking about Snowden and what he did is that in all of it, there's not a single incident of abuse. One of these programs was authorized by a vote in the Patriot Act. There were members of Congress who knew all about it. If you wanted to go and look at the particular phone calls or emails of a particular person, you had to go to court and get permission of a judge. It's no different then if the police want to put a wiretap on your phone now, they have to go to the court and ask for permission to do it. So you had all these safeguards built in. There is no example that he came up with where it's abuse. So what did we gain from it? I don't know if we gained anything. Did we lose something? The government says we did. The program has been exposed, and therefore certain operations are been damaged. I don't know that that's true. I don't know that it's false, but I have to accept what they say.
A number of other individuals, including House Speaker John Boehner, has called him a traitor. Do you think he's a traitor?
No. I mean, I don't think he purposely set out to harm the United States of America. He hasn't sold it to a government. But I don't think he's a hero either. I think he's deluded. I think he may be a highly emotional person. I don't know. But if you compare him to Daniel Ellsberg, which a lot of people have, including Daniel Ellsberg, I would say with Daniel Ellsberg, he revealed the Pentagon Papers, I learned a lot, namely that my government was consistently lying to me. I haven't found this out from Snowden.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about digital activists, so-called hacktivists, Edward Snowden in particular. We're talking about how their actions should be viewed. Are they ethical? Are they morally questionable? Our guests are Richard Cohen. He's a columnist for The Washington Post who recently wrote about this, and Gabriella Coleman. She's an author and an expert, an anthropologist who's immersed herself in the world of digital activism. Gabriella Coleman, it's interesting. A number of people who've written about this who are critical of Edward Snowden have called him a narcissist. I'm interested in that, why they've chosen that term. But one of the points that they've made consistently is that unlike, say, the civil rights activists in past years, like Medgar Evers, did not have the means to participate in the activities of the government with which they disagreed. I mean, they were aggressively barred from voting. So, you know, civil rights activism was really their only choice. And a number of people have made the point that Edward Snowden had all these means available to him. He can vote. He can be active. He could contact his elected officials. What do you say to that?
First of all, I think it takes remarkable courage to be critical from within an institution. But about the kind of available means for meaningful change, I believe that he had none. And the reason for this is, I'll take the example of Thomas Drake, who worked for the NSA and who absolutely took the available channels available to him, both internally to the NSA and going to Congress. And he got in a lot of trouble.
Remind us again of what he did.
He also claims that Americans are being spied on and that there weren't safeguards within the NSA programs for American citizens and their data. And he went to people within the NSA, as well as lawmakers, as well as journalists, to talk about it so that journalists would write stories about this. Basically, he was charged under the Espionage Act, and eventually the case fell because he never leaked any classified information. Mm. And people like Thomas Drake and other journalists have consistently tried to get answers from Congress. And it doesn't seem like there are legal channels available for people both within and also outside the establishment to make meaningful change. And this is one of the reasons why people turn to civil disobedience and direct action.
Hmm. Richard Cohen, what about that? I mean, the argument is that it's that there is no way out of that closed universe except to go public. In fact, a number of people have pointed to the fact that there are members of Congress, senators, who said that they also had reservations about this program, but were constrained from discussing it because they had access to classified information. What do you say about that?
The fact of the matter was that this was not a question of the bureaucracy imposing some sort of policy and nobody knowing about it. This was a matter of Congress passing a law, which was known at the time. I always knew that this program existed because I know that Google has this information. If Google has it, I'm sure the government has it. You go on the internet, you give up privacy to a certain extent. There is a difference between privacy and anonymity. The government may monitor my pattern of my emails and my telephone calls, but if they want to find out what I'm saying and who I am, then that's a different matter. Then they have to go to the court and ask the court for permission to do it. Now, you may think the court is lax, it's too permissive. There are problems with it, but I say we have to stay diligent on this thing.
What should happen now, Richard? Should he go to jail?
Look, I don't want to see him go to jail. I mean, I don't see him as a criminal. I think the government is going to try to put him in jail.
If what he did was wrong and it compromises the safety of his fellow countrymen, why shouldn't he go to jail?
I know, but I don't think he set out to do anything. I mean, I don't really know the guy. And the, you know, the profile you get of him is that he is a little, you know, not a little, but plenty melodramatic, maybe, you know, was deluded into thinking he was doing something heroic and right. I don't think he was doing something heroic and right. But jail, I'm glad I'm not a judge because I probably couldn't send anybody to jail. So.
Okay, fair point. Gabriella, though, what about the point that if this is indeed an act of civil disobedience, that he should stand before a judge and jury of his peers and use that opportunity to express his moral opposition to the law? Because, I mean, the argument here is that, you know, at any given time, there are many decisions that the country has made through their elected representatives with which an individual citizen might disagree. That if everybody just feels that they cannot follow rules and agreements that they have themselves made voluntarily, I mean, he signed a confidentiality agreement, then we have chaos. What about that?
It's absolutely the case that he broke the law, and there's two comments there. First of all sorts of laws have been passed that then we overturn and disagree with, both through legal channels as well as through civil disobedience, right? I mean, slavery is just one of many, many examples. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. And that's precisely why his action is so important, is that he opens that question, and precisely his action then foments a grassroots movement, and that's happening with groups such as Stop Watching Us, which then are using the legal channels to foment change. So in some ways, he opens the door for legal action. When you break the law, I do believe you should be accountable. He came forward, and yet I understand his reluctance. You know, he's not boarding a plane to the United States because he sees what's happening with Bradley Manning. He knows that he potentially faces a lifetime in jail. And while he would probably, you know, I'm speaking for him, and that's, you know, total conjecture, he might be willing to do some time, but a lifetime, that's absolutely too harsh.
Gabrielle Coleman is author of Coding Freedom, The Aesthetics and the Ethics of Hacking. We reached her in Montreal. Richard Cohen is a columnist for The Washington Post. We reached him in New York. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, after half a century of denial, the British government is acknowledging the torture of colonial subjects in Kenya.
And of course, as I was told quite publicly in open lectures, that, you know, well, Africans make up stories, Elkins. So this is just one big myth.
We'll talk with the American professor who helped uncover the abuses. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. The U.S. auto industry is doing more with less, a lot less. Here are a few things to consider. There are fewer car assembly plants in the United States. There are also hundreds of thousands fewer workers than there were before the recession. But productivity is the highest it's ever been, and profits are high, too. NPR's Sonari Glinton looks at why that won't translate into more jobs.
You know how when you take an embarrassing fall and people all rush up to you and ask, are you all right? Even after you're back on your feet? Well, that's how it's been with the car business.
People ask a lot, is the auto industry back? It depends on what scale you want to look at.
That's Kristen Dietschik. She's the research director at the Center for Automotive Research. So if we're looking at scales, let's start with productivity. In this case, how many work hours it takes to build the car.
Productivity in our automotive plants in the U.S. is 39% higher than it was in the year 2000. Productivity has never been this high.
And while sales aren't as high as they once were, vehicle prices are up, so profitability is up. General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler have all been making money, and they've been rewarding their workers with profit-sharing checks. And all the companies, foreign and domestic, are investing billions of dollars in North American facilities. You think this would translate into a hiring frenzy, right? Well, Dietschik says, not so much.
In employment, we're still down a lot. The peak before the crash was over 1 million, and we're at about 670,000, 660,000 employees in motor vehicle and parts manufacturing in the U.S. So employment's still got a long way to go.
Here's the thing. The car companies are adding workers, but the addition of those workers is sort of slow and steady. A few thousand here, a few hundred there. The plants in the U.S. and North America are running at full steam. Every single plant that makes cars on this continent is at or near capacity in terms of number of shifts or hours worked. And car plants that used to, say, have one assembly line now have two, with the same amount of space and workers. Michael Robinette is an analyst with IHS Automotive.
There's no doubt that the industry is stressed right now. It's stressed at the vehicle assembly facility. It's stressed where they make engines and transmissions, and it's definitely stressed within the supply community.
Plants have added second and third shifts, and they're less likely to shut down or go on their formerly traditional summer breaks. Robinette says the car companies, both foreign and domestic, have learned the lessons of the economic crash well, almost too well.
The days of 2008 and 2009 still linger in our industry, and therefore everybody's being very, very careful about adding capacity, whether in the form of brick and mortar or in the form of new employees, and only adding them when it's absolutely necessary or they see a road in the future where it's going to be fully utilized.
Robinette says the car companies are not ready to expand the number of plants in the U.S. unless they're absolutely sure they'll be needed for a long, long time. Meanwhile, companies like Volkswagen are building plants in Mexico. New plants in places such as Michigan or even Mississippi just don't seem to be on the horizon. Robinette says, though, the car business has sort of hit its sweet spot.
The industry is back. It's in a happy place. The world is now looking for more vehicles built in North America, and certainly exports are going to be on the rise. That's a great ending comment, by the way. That one's a keeper.
You know what? I think I will. Sonarian Glenton, NPR News.
A once promising electric car company recently filed for bankruptcy. The company, Better Place, was building a network of battery swapping stations. Instead of spending time charging up, you do a fast swap and drive away. It spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this network, but sold only about 1,000 cars. Now the owners of the Israeli company are pinning their hopes on an entrepreneur named Captain Sunshine to be their savior. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Getting a fresh car battery at a Better Place station is easy. Just shift into neutral and take out the key.
So it's going to pick us up. It's going to move us forward. The battery's going to drop out.
Debbie Abramowitz bought this car last summer. She loves it.
The new battery is then going to be moved into position and put in. Then the sign will say go, and we'll start the car again, and we'll have a full battery.
This takes 6 minutes, 24 seconds. Debbie's husband, Haim, timed it. When they plug the car in at home in Jerusalem, it takes hours to recharge. The swap stations let them roam freely.
We woke up one Thursday morning, took off an hour later, no planning.
They drove all day, visiting scenic spots around Israel.
Never did we have a problem or concern about electrical charge because there's switch stations all along the way.
Better Place supporters thought the battery swap system would fundamentally change the electric car business. Instead, the company burned cash building it, but made little in return. Since Better Place declared bankruptcy, potential buyer Yosef Abramowitz has been looking at the books.
I'll give you one example. The software that they have for the customer relations management, they bought a license for 1 million customers. 1 million customers, and they didn't get to 1,000. And they're paying for that license for 1 million customers. So we're finding that basically with almost every contract that there was not an attention to detail to watch their investors' money closely.
Abramowitz, not related to car owners Debbie and Haim, is a successful Israeli solar power entrepreneur. He's also known as Captain Sunshine.
Shalom, shalom. Chiyuchim v'tzchok, nachon?
Okay. At a recent rally of a couple hundred Better Place car owners, Abramowitz showed up in a yellow yarmulke and a silky yellow cape. He was Captain Sunshine, laying out his Save the Company vision for the crowd.
We're saying to the government and to the army, 20% of your fleets should be electric cars. Do you agree?
Yes!
We're saying to the finance ministry, zero usage tax and zero purchase tax. Do you agree?
Yes!
And we're saying, of course, we would like to add renewable energy to power our cars. Do you agree?
Yes!
The idea is this. With the right government support, the car owners could form a co-op, join with a few investors, and buy the company cheap. They'd run it prudently, build thousands more charging stations, stations that would be solar-powered. But the revolutionary idea, the battery swap stations, would be over. Or almost.
It's not that it's over, but it's going to be limited to the current car owners and the current car. We really see a lot of the electric vehicles in the future to be a second family car for the local errands.
In other words, instead of taking a road trip, you'd have to stick closer to home, just like almost every electric car. Neve Ellis is a business reporter with the Jerusalem Post.
It's not the same as the sort of visionary level of Better Place, which found a way around major problems that no one else had figured out how to do. I mean, it's not a new idea to say, well, let's see how much we can get from renewable sources and plug that into the grid. So I don't think that it's on the same order of magnitude.
The next life of Better Place is in the hands of a liquidator now. Car owners and Captain Sunshine hope to be running it by July. Emily Harris, NPR News.